in state of Minnesota, or actually Eddie Markeith Frazier versus state of Minnesota A22-0441. Would counsel for appellant please introduce himself for the record and begin your argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Eddie Frazier, on this case. Mr. Frazier entered an Alford plea, in this case, to second-degree intentional murder. For that Alford plea to be accurate, Mr. Frazier had to acknowledge that a jury would likely find him guilty of intentional murder at trial. And further, the court needed to find a strong probability that Mr. Frazier would be convicted of intentional murder at trial. Whenever the heat of passion issue is presented in an intentional homicide case, the state must prove that the defendant did not act in the heat of passion.
Counsel, before you get way deep into the weeds, because I know that's where we're going in this case, I just want some clarification at the front end.
Sure.
Did your client raise the possibility of a heat of passion defense, lesser included offense, jury instruction, prior to agreeing to the Alford plea and tendering his basis for that plea? In other words, did he put everyone on notice that it was his belief that his actions were justified in the heat of passion, such that that issue had to be addressed by the court and part of the plea colloquy?
He did not. But it's
so my next question then is, why are we going down this path? Because if he had gone to trial and if he had wanted a lesser included instruction on heat of passion murder, he would have had to request it. And the judge would have had to decide whether or not it was appropriate to give that instruction, which a decision that is, you know, likely made during the trial or towards the end of the trial when the judge knows what the evidence was. But at the very least, a judge would have to decide whether or not your client was entitled to that lesser included instruction. So I'm having a hard time understanding how your client now gets to say after the plea, his plea is invalid because his plea did not disprove the possibility of heat of passion defense or lesser included, when the burden was on your client to raise that issue and he did not do so.
I would disagree that the burden was on him to raise the issue. Under Dahlin and Leinweber, the court has an independent duty to instruct the jury on heat of passion when there's a reasonable view of the evidence that could support heat of passion. So I know the state refers to it as a burden of production, but that's not the way that heat of passion was treated in Leinweber or in the discussion of it in Dahlin.
What was the evidence in this case that would have cued the district court in on the notion that heat of passion was at play as a mitigating factor?
There are two pieces of likely evidence that we point to that would have been produced at trial. The first is Mr. Frazier's admission that was included in the state's allegations as part of the complaint that he killed the victim in response to her stabbing him during a domestic argument. That admission, it's our position, would have likely come in at trial either as part of the state's case in chief or Mr. Frazier giving that testimony himself.
Why wouldn't it be self-defense that you're arguing the court had a duty to also resolve during the colloquy on the plea in order to make it an effective plea? It seems like your argument would go to a whole number of defenses that usually have to be raised at some point by the defendant. So I suppose you would believe that the plea was also invalid on the ground that the district court or the prosecutor didn't have your client acknowledge that the evidence would have been sufficient to disprove self-defense, correct?
No, I disagree with that. And the key point would be that heat of passion is not an affirmative defense. It's different than self-defense. It's different than duress. It's different than all of these affirmative defenses that are listed in the rules of criminal procedure that a defendant must raise before trial. It's a critical fact.
But just to be clear, though, It's the same in the sense that the state has the burden in each one of those as well.
Yes. Correct? But the obligation of a defendant to have an initial burden of production is not present in heat of passion as it would be for other affirmative defenses. So although the state bears a similar ultimate burden of persuasion, heat of passion is not an affirmative defense. It's under Mulaney and this court's decision in Green, it's a critical fact that the state must prove to distinguish the crime, the more serious crime of intentional murder from the lesser crime of first degree manslaughter.
Before you continue, could you give me the cite for the Dahlin case, which you indicate says that a district court has an obligation to instruct the jury on heat of passion, even if it's not raised?
Sure, Your Honor. So Dahlin is 695 NW2D 588. The relevant passage where it says that is, we emphasize that neither the prosecution nor the defense can limit the submission of such lesser degrees as the trial court determined should be submitted. Even though defendant has expressed or impliedly waived a jury instruction, a trial court may, in its discretion, ignore the waiver and give any instructions warranted by the evidence. And in that passage, Dahlin cites the line waiver in which the court stated, in a murder case, it is preeminently the trial court's duty in the exercise of its discretion to determine what lesser degrees of homicide to submit. This duty is founded upon the general principles regarding jury instructions that the court references, and neither the prosecution nor the defense can limit the submission of such lesser degrees as the trial court determined should be submitted. And it goes on to say, it is the duty of the trial court to submit such lesser degrees as it determines.
Mr. McLaughlin, if I could take a step back, we're talking about the context of an Alford plea, not whether the district court abuses discretion in terms of jury instructions. And so the first question I have for you is there any case that says a defendant has to, at the Alford stage, in order to make an adequate Alford plea, admit specifically that the jury would find each element proven? And to go element by element at the Alford stage. What case requires that, if any?
My response would be that the Alford plea has consistently been characterized by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court as a more rigorous test of accuracy than applies in general guilty pleas. General guilty pleas establish that every element must be established as part of a defendant's guilty plea. And since an Alford plea has to go beyond that and is a more rigorous test, the Alford plea accuracy standard must at minimum include what's required for a normal guilty plea, which is that each element is established.
Do you think that's the right way of characterizing Alford pleas? I mean, just putting aside case law, sure. It seems to me that when you say more rigorous, that doesn't exactly accurately describe the point of an Alford plea, where the state would lay out a brief summary of the evidence and the questions that the defendant is asked. Have you reviewed the evidence with your attorney, reviewed the complaint? And then there's a general question, right? And I'm not aware of any case that says that general question is too general and requires some more rigorous or more specific admission, element by element, that the jury, based on this evidence, would find each element proven, right? It's a general question that we time and again say is sufficient.
I would just add that the general question, though, that's sort of at the core of an Alford plea is whether a defendant rationally determines that despite his or her claim of innocence, it's in his interest to plead guilty because of the high likelihood of conviction at trial.
Well, I mean, the question is, do you think the jury would find you guilty applying the presumption of innocence? So that's the question that we require district courts to ask, right?
But I think a defendant can't answer that question unless he knows what the jury would need to find at trial. And when heat of passion is presented, the jury would need to find at trial that he did not act in heat of passion. So really the defendant can't make...
So Mr. McLaughlin, my point is, it seems like you're asking us to say that general question is no longer enough in an Alford plea. That in every Alford plea going forward, you now have to go beyond that to make sure the defendant understands what potential theories of defense he might raise at trial, what affirmative defenses he might want to raise at trial, what elements he would be disputing at trial, and then to ask the defendant, in light of all of that, he's giving up or he's agreeing that the jury would reject any or in all of those. It seems like that's your real argument, is that the general statement is no longer sufficient.
Well, I mean, I'd agree that our position would be that the defendant has to understand each element the state would have to prove at trial, based on the evidence presented at trial. I don't think our rule would need to go as far as you stated, where the defendant would have to understand every potential defense in the way that would interact with the state's proof. But at a minimum, the defendant should need to know what the state needs to prove at trial and should agree that the evidence that would be presented at trial would be sufficient for a jury to find him guilty.
And the current process, you're saying, is not enough. So if we ask a defendant at the Alford plea, you had some time to talk to your attorney, you understand the charges, you've talked with him about defenses, you understand the evidence, this evidence is enough. You're saying that that typical inquiry is no longer enough, that you have to be more specific than that.
I think in any guilty plea, the court has to establish the defendant's, has to establish each element of the offense that the evidence after the guilty plea establishes each element. So I would agree that the Alford plea doesn't establish a lower rule than applies at other pleas. So the defendant has to understand each element that the state would prove at trial and has to agree that the evidence establishes each element.
Okay. So again, we don't have a case that says you have to ask that key Alford question with regard to each specific element, right? That'd be a new thing we're doing.
No cases had that specific holding, but
in fact, we have cases that hold the opposite, that say you don't have to go element by element. But let's assume you did. Let's assume we're going to overrule those other cases. We're going to establish a new rule that says it has to be more specific. Then the question is, I mean, you're not saying this is an element. Absence of heat of passion, you agree, is not an element, or are you arguing it is an element?
It's under Mullaney versus Wilbur and under Green, it's a critical fact the state must prove when the issue is presented at trial. I mean, so in that sense, it is an element once the issue is presented. It's part of the state's burden of proof as its case in chief. So
do you think that's a change, that we would be saying it's no longer a critical fact, it's now an element? Or do you think critical fact is an element?
That's how Mullaney versus Wilbur. Mullaney versus Wilbur characterized critical fact under the same rubric as Winship. It said, you know, in the main statute at issue there, it characterized heat of passion as a mitigating sentencing factor. And the Supreme Court said it doesn't matter that the intentional murder statute in Maine didn't put this as an element. We're going to treat it like elements under Winship. So that's that under that case, and how this court looked at it in Green, I think it has the function of an element. I mean, we agree with the state's, you know, position that it's not listed in the second degree murder statute 60919. But, you know, in Green, this court found that if you look at intentional murder and first degree manslaughter together, you do find a statutory basis for that burden. So it's not as if the statute is silent on it.
Now, heat of passion has been a factor in criminal law since before the codification of criminal law. And it's my understanding that heat of passion as a mitigating factor still permeates the law in virtually every other state. And Alford pleas, of course, are part of the rubric across the nation. It's not just a Minnesota thing. So I'm assuming that somewhere in your research, you have found a case somewhere in the country that supports the proposition that you are asking us to hold in this case.
Your Honor, I did not find a case directly on point with this issue. I mean, it's and part of that is
that, did you find a case that was even arguably supportive of this proposition that you'd like us to hold as a matter of law?
I mean, I think it, again, not factually, but I think, you know, following for what an Alford plea is about, that it's about a defendant looking at the likelihood of conviction after trial and deciding it's in his interest to plead guilty, even though it's maintaining innocence, that the defendant has to have a clear-eyed view of what trial would be. And if,
right, but in the cases that even the affirmative defenses that you'd say are, well, that's different because they're affirmative defenses, Well, the same thing would apply as a matter of logic, wouldn't it? I mean, the defendant wouldn't be pleading guilty unless the defendant thought, well, oh, wait a minute. You mean I could raise self-defense and that might have happened in this case? Well, why wouldn't the court be obliged, whether it's an affirmative defense or not, to also put that on the table expressly for the defendant before accepting a guilty plea? I don't understand the logic why we would distinguish those two.
Well, and I think as a consequence of a plea, a defendant is making a decision rather than asserting possible defenses at trial. It's going to plead guilty. So it's a defendant's decision. And I think you can, in that circumstance, you can use the fact of the plea to, you know, support an argument that the defendant was giving up what he could have done at trial. And deciding to plead guilty instead. I think key to passion is different because it operates independent of the defendant. Defendant's testimony can repudiate key to passion, and the court still has to instruct the jury.
So one last question. How much, if you don't, I'm Judge Larkin, if I may, the time has expired.
But I have one as well.
So how much, it didn't leap off the page at me when I saw the facts that were being presented in the Alford plea, that this was, that heat of passion was even a factor. How much evidence is necessary before it is required for a district court to introduce sua sponte heat of passion when you don't even have a trial and all you have are the facts as presented here? What is the rule of law that you would say not just requires it? I'm assuming you're saying it's not required in every case for the district court to introduce the heat of passion during the plea colloquy. So what exactly is the legal standard that we would apply and say, here's when the district court should know that you have a sua sponte obligation in an Alford plea to introduce heat of passion as an element, fact, or however you want us to describe it?
I would say that if there's evidence in the record at the time of the guilty plea that supports a conclusion that there would have been evidence offered at trial that could support a jury instruction for heat of passion manslaughter. And again, that standard is a low bar for when that instruction is required. You know, you look at the evidence, the light most favorable to the defendant.
But you believe, just so we're clear, you believe that if the only evidence that came into trial in this case was the representations made during the plea colloquy, that would have put the district court in this case on notice. The district court had an absolute obligation to introduce heat of passion as a jury consideration.
I mean, I think the question isn't what.
Well, could you answer the question that I'm asking?
Sure.
Would you think the facts as presented in the plea colloquy here, you think that would be enough if that's what was presented at trial, that the district court, based on the case law, would be required to advise the jury, even if it's not requested by the defendant? Would it be required to advise the jury as to heat of passion as a possible mitigating factor?
I think it's a close question on what was actually presented at the plea. What if that itself would have justified an instruction?
Well, let me pause you.
Sure.
If it's not clear that that's enough, even if we were to say there's this new thing that the district court has to do in an Alford plea, if it's not clear, then why would we say the district court inappropriately accepted the guilty plea in this case?
Because I think the inquiry has to be what evidence would have been admitted, offered at trial. Not what
how
was
offered. How would the district court possibly know what evidence is introduced at trial based upon what was offered? Why would the district court assume that any more evidence would be offered at trial than what was presented?
When I just take a step back, the entire grand jury transcript was offered as part of the plea. So just from that evidence, the district court would have had before it evidence that a bloody knife was found at the scene and that the victim didn't have any knife wounds on her body. And the district court also had before it the complaint in this case in which Mr. Frazier stated that the victim stabbed him. So the combination of the grand jury testimony that the court had plus what was in the state's complaint, that's the basis for the instruction. That's our argument for why the court would have had to get the instruction.
I have one question which I'd like you to try to answer in rebuttal. To the extent you're arguing that lack of heat of passion is an element of murder two, yet you're agreeing that heat of passion, lesser included, need not be submitted, to the jury in every case. How do we equate it with an element? Because in my thinking, an element is certain, must be proved in every single case. How could we then say lack of heat of passion is an element of murder too, while at the same time agreeing that heat of passion murder instruction need not be given in every case? So maybe you could resolve that conflict for me, and which is why I went to notice and jury instructions in the first place. And at this point, I think it's time to hear from counsel for the state. Mr. Bueller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this case. I'm appearing from Crookston this morning. At the outset, let me apologize to the court. There was a screw up on my behalf. I didn't even realize that this had been placed, that this was scheduled for oral argument. It wasn't on my calendar. That is solely my responsibility. In 28 years appearing before this court, I've never screwed up so bad, and I can't tell you how embarrassed that I am.
Apologies. I also was accepted. And as long as I got to say Bueller, I don't think anybody got the joke, but I'm a child of the 80s.
I've been hearing that for a long time, Your Honor.
And I apologize on behalf of the court for Judge Larkin's joke.
Thank you. I was the prosecutor who handled this case, so I'm not just the appellate attorney in this case. And that's one reason that I spent a lot of time in my brief going through the facts of this case, because appellant didn't do so. I think the issue is very simple in this case, and that is, if you look at the evidence that was presented at the time of the guilty plea, and that's the only evidence that you're looking at in determining whether or not this guilty plea was accurate, was that sufficient for the district court, originally Judge Marvin, to find a sufficient factual basis for the defendant's Alford-type guilty plea? Now, counsel started going into issues about knowledge and understanding in the charges. That issue was specifically waived by appellant before the district court. You know, this was one of the issues that we originally were going to have a post-conviction hearing on, was whether or not appellant's counsel needed to testify about his explaining to the defendant the nature of the charges. And appellant's counsel specifically made it clear that there was no argument whatsoever with regard to the defendant's knowledge or the intelligence requirement to the guilty plea. This was simply whether the guilty plea was accurate. And he also conceded that was to be based upon the evidence that was submitted at the time the guilty plea was entered. You know, there was some discussion about going through a guilty plea element by element. I actually did that in this case. I read the charge to the appellant, explaining what I would have to prove at trial with regard to murder in the second degree, went through the individual elements, and the only dispute raised by appellant's counsel at the district court level was the issue with regard to intent. That was the only issue that was disputed. Never were the words heat of passion ever brought up before the district court. And
well,
we're talking about 2 years of litigation.
But if, Mr. Bueller, though, you would agree, if it's the district court's obligation to include a heat of passion fact, element, or however you want to describe it, and introduce it into the discussion at the Alford plea, that it doesn't matter whether it was raised or not before the district court at the time of the plea.
Well, the issue, Judge, is there is no obligation on a district court to raise that issue sua sponte, or for any party to negate that it's part of a guilty plea.
Right, but that's the argument being made. So the fact that, I mean, it's the appellant's making the argument that the district court had that duty sua sponte. So the fact that it wasn't raised in the district court is sort of subsumed in that entire issue that we have to decide.
And I agree, but the more direct point, Your Honor, is that this is a post-conviction proceeding. This is not a direct appeal. So appellant's conviction is presumed to be valid. It's his affirmative burden to prove that it's invalid. And that has to be done based upon existing law. You can't use post-conviction relief proceedings to either announce or create new rules of constitutional criminal procedure.
Mr. Bueller, if I can pinpoint, there's lots of layers here potentially to this argument. Let me put aside whether or not you characterize absence of heat of passion as a critical fact or an element. Let's put aside the obligation a district court judge has in certain circumstances to sua sponte, instruct the jury, because we're talking about an Alford plea. And at that stage, there's no case that requires hypothetical jury instructions to be given to a defendant before going through an Alford plea. So the obligation of sua sponte instructing the jury, it may not be relevant. So my pinpoint question is, let's assume it's an element. Let's assume that we equate this critical fact to an element. Is there any case you're aware of that requires, and I'm not talking about the factual basis portion where you're or the prosecutor is summarizing the evidence. I'm talking about the admission portion where the defendant says, based on all of that evidence, I agree the jury would find me guilty applying the presumption of innocence. Is there any requirement that or any case that you know of that could support the argument that that's too general a question, that in the future, what we need to do to be constitutional on an Alford plea is to break that into each specific element and get a separate admission. The jury would find this element has been met, met beyond a reasonable doubt based on this evidence. Do you think the jury would make that? So is there any case that you're aware of that would support that argument?
None, Your Honor. In fact, I go back to Alford itself, in which the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that the basis for the plea was just so there was so a district court could conclude itself or an appellate court later on that there's a sufficient record being made that the defendant's decision was an intelligent one. That is, that he was exercising a choice and made a valid one based upon the evidence. There was absolutely no discussion in that case, and I'm not aware of any case since that has required a element by element analysis. And in this case, even if there was, the only disputed element related to the intent.
What about a similar question, though, but specific not to elements, but to affirmative defenses? Let's assume there had been notice given of a self-defense defense, and everyone knows that's going to be the issue at trial. Is there any case that obligates at the Alford stage the district court to have a defendant admit the jury would reject that defense?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. In fact, I think Nace and Koshevar and several of this court's unpublished opinions citing to those decisions have rejected that argument in the guilty plea context. And one reason I say that is, in virtually every Alford plea, in my experience, the defendant has got some reason to believe he's not guilty, that he's got in a defense that may not fly in front of a jury, that he subjectively believes he didn't commit the crime. There's some reason for him entering that Alford plea. Granted, there are some defendants who just won't acknowledge guilt under any circumstances, but most defendants have some reason to that they're unwilling to admit it because they might believe they've got a defense. If every prosecutor in every case now has to go through the litany of defenses and try to figure out which one it is, and then a district court to advise a defendant on that, I don't know how we'd ever have a valid guilty plea.
I mean, the whole point of the Alford plea is that the defendant's maintaining innocence, but agreeing that the jury would disagree with that and agreeing that the jury would find him guilty despite him or her maintaining innocence. So I can understand why there might be some constitutional basis to go beyond the general question of would they find you guilty or would they reject your self-defense defense or other affirmative defense. What's your response to the argument that because we have case law saying it's a more rigorous process or requires a more rigorous, in terms of accuracy, a more rigorous inquiry at the Alford plea and saying that that somehow is requiring more than a regular plea. What do you make of that argument as a basis to support asking something beyond that general question?
Well, I'll just use this case as the best example, Your Honor. What more could I or the district court have done? There was absolutely no notice anywhere in this case that heat of passion was going to be an issue at trial. One reason, I believe, was because that the defendant also had been indicted for murder in the second degree, unintentional murder, because he committed this murder in violation of a no contact order. The Minnesota Supreme Court has left open the issue in Van Curen as to whether or not a defendant can even argue heat of passion of those under those circumstances, because by arguing that I didn't intentionally kill the victim, but did in fact do so, and there's a no contact order in place, is tantamount to admission to murder in the second degree. But if you look through the evidence in this case, the only evidence counsel points to are a couple of false exculpatory statements that the defendant made initially that I included in a complaint on the day that the murder occurred in order to get an arrest warrant for him. Now, of course, that complaint was superseded by the grand jury indictment. But at the guilty plea hearing, his counsel never raised the issue that, hold on a second, he had a valid heat of passion argument that we need to negate here before this guilty plea is valid. And he had an experience, one of the more experienced attorneys in Northwest Minnesota representing him. And counsel's argument about the crime scene also ignores the fact that it was the defendant who staged the entire crime scene. In fact, dragging the victim's body from the bedroom to the bathroom, disrobing her, putting drug paraphernalia, an alcohol bottle, stripping her naked, filling the bathtub with water. He's the one who staged the entire crime scene, But now he wants to argue that something that he finds at the scene would support an argument for heat of passion. I would have loved to have cross-examined Mr. Frazier at trial, a 20-time convicted felon at that time. And the statements that he made to others about how he killed her, that he bear hugged her, being patently false, I don't think there would have been any basis for a jury to acquit him. But more importantly, I'm not even certain there would have been a valid factual basis to get a manslaughter instruction to the jury. And I do want to point out one thing with regard to counsel's argument. He continues to cite to Mulaney as somehow supporting his argument. And Mulaney made it clear that this heat of passion is only an issue when it's properly presented in a homicide case. But the court went on and noted many states do require the defendant to show that there is some evidence indicating that he acted in the heat of passion before requiring the prosecution to negate this element by proving the absence of passion. And that's exactly what Minnesota has done. We've treated this as a burden of production. The defendant's got to at least put some evidence in, either if he doesn't testify, at least to point to objective evidence in the record. And there's none at the guilty plea hearing. Again, if we're talking about whether this is guilty plea accurate based upon the evidence that was before the district court in the hearing, there's nothing in that record that would have put the district court or myself on notice that had to negate heat of passion in this case. And that's consistent with the fact that, to be honest, heat of passion never is an issue in a homicide case until you get to trial. That is the only time that heat of passion is in issue is when you get to trial. It's at that point, at the conclusion of the prosecution's case or at the conclusion of the defense's case, if the defense puts it on, that a judge then determines whether or not a jury instruction would be warranted. Judge doesn't do that ahead of time. I would note in this case, when the judge was going to instruct the jury, it was simply on the charges that the defendant had been indicted on. The appellant's attorney actually agreed to the preliminary jury instructions. The only correction he made was with the fact that there were two attorneys rather than one representing Mr. Frazier at trial. He never said at that point, we need to instruct the jury on heat of passion. In fact, if this was going to be an element of the crime, deemed to be an element of the crime or a lesser included offense that the jury had to be instructed on, one would have thought that the jury would have been instructed that at the outset by the district court. That goes to show heat of passion was never an issue in this case because it never went to trial and was not raised by admissible evidence at trial. No, counsel likes to tap dance around this by claiming that, well, Mr. Frazier could have put the evidence in because it was in the complaint, the state had to introduce it. That's almost absurd. I often put defendants' false exculpatory statements in complaints to point out a guilty consciousness argument. And in this case, his statements were patently false. He didn't bear hug the victim to death. He manually strangled her for over 4 minutes and then staged the crime scene, stole her car, stole her money, took off to the Twin Cities, fled from law enforcement. There is not a single action that the defendant engaged during this crime, including the interfering with the 911 call, barricading the door, calling back and falsely identifying himself and claiming it was his granddaughter. There's not a single shred of evidence in this case that would have pointed to an objective person that heat of passion was in issue. And if it was, I would have expected appellant's very experienced counsel to have raised that issue at some point in time in either one of his briefs before the district court, prior to trial, even at the guilty plea hearing. But it never came up at the guilty plea hearing. It didn't come up after the guilty plea hearing. It didn't come up at sentencing. It was never raised. This is simply an argument that's being raised almost 2 years after the fact. So Mr. Frazier can have the trial that he stated under oath he absolutely did not want, because he thought the evidence was more than sufficient to find him guilty of murder in the second degree intentional. And I believe when it's all said and done, the fact that counsel cannot cite to any decision, published or unpublished in this state, or from any other state, or from any other court in America, state or federal, dooms his argument. Because this is a post-conviction relief proceeding, you cannot announce a new rule of criminal procedure to grant him post-conviction relief. T versus Lane, Danforth versus State make that clear. That's why this is different than a direct appeal. And the fact that counsel does not cite to anything to support his argument that heat of passion must be negated in a guilty plea, in the guilty plea context, dooms his argument. And I know counsel likes to cite to State versus Green. He's argued it this morning several times. I would note that Green has absolutely nothing to do with a guilty plea and doesn't even have to do with the instruction on heat of passion. It simply had to do whether the issue was whether or not the jury had been properly instructed on the burden of proof. And after a remand from the Minnesota Supreme Court, this court of appeal, this court actually affirmed the defendant's conviction. So counsel likes to take dicta from that case and somehow extrapolate it into a holding that has never been embraced by any court in this state or anywhere else. I see I'm just about out of town here. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I thank you for the opportunity to appear this morning. And again, I really do want to apologize for screwing up the way I did.
Thank you. Any additional questions, Mr. Bueller? All right, rebuttal argument, please.
I guess I'd like to begin with just to address Judge Bryan's inquiry about in an Alford plea, whether the elements have to be addressed specifically. I'd point the court to State versus Tice. And in that case, you know, the court discussed the general requirement of accuracy in any plea to establish the elements of the offense. But then also went on to say that the defendant has to specifically acknowledge that the evidence is sufficient for a jury applying a reasonable doubt standard to find him guilty. And sufficiency requires that each element of the offense is met. So I do think under Tice, there is a requirement now for plea that the defendant must acknowledge that the state would have met each aspect of his burden.
You don't make a distinction between generally the evidence is sufficient to convict and the evidence is sufficient for a jury to find element one has been proven. Yeah. The evidence is sufficient to find element two. Yeah. You see no distinction there?
Well, I think sufficiency requires every element to be met. So unless each element is addressed, you can't determine whether something's sufficient or not, is what I'd say. So,
could you answer my question? Why should we treat this as an element if it's not necessarily something that has to be determined in every case?
I think because in this case, it's our position that it would have been something that needed to be determined because of what would have happened at trial.
If you're going to ask us to hold that it's an element, it's then required in every case. And I don't see how that can be the situation when it depends on the circumstances of a particular case. Could you address that concern?
Sure. And my most simple response would be that heat of passion is different. It is an unusual situation because it's something where the state has a burden if the issue is presented, but it's not an affirmative defense that the defendant has to raise. So it is something where the element really depends on whether the issue is presented at trial. And if it is presented, then the state does have that burden to prove that critical fact. And that's what Mullaney held. Mr. Bueller argued that the citations of Green are dicta, but in Robinson, the Supreme Court essentially adopted Mullaney as a matter of state law, holding that due process requires the state to disprove heat of passion when the issue is presented. So it's not as if Green is the only authority for that proposition, and it's settled law in Minnesota that if the issue is presented, the state does have that burden. Heat of passion is sort of a unique factual circumstance, but Mullaney did determine it was a critical fact, and it did group heat of passion with elements under Winship and the elements that a state has to prove as a matter of due process. That'd be my response to that. Mr. Bueller argued that with the complaint doesn't show that the state wouldn't have been bound to introduce the evidence in the complaint at trial. And we wouldn't dispute that. Of course, the state can make its own decision about how it wants to present its case. But our position is that the complaint is at least probative of what the state would have offered at trial. It is the initial charging document that provides the defendant notice of what the state's factual basis for the offense is. So it is at least probative of what the state would do. And then beyond that, Mr. Frazier could have introduced those statements at trial himself as well. So at least the complaint's at least strong, it's at least highly probative of what would have happened at trial. It's not only the complaint, it's also this evidence that there was a bloody knife found at the scene and that the victim did not have stab wounds on her body. And that evidence was expressly part of the plea that the state adopted because it was part of the grand jury testimony. So, we have a defendant claiming that the victim stabbed him, a bloody knife, and the victim having no stab wounds on her body. those facts, in our view, taken together, would have supported a jury instruction on manslaughter, that Mr. Frazier committed this crime in response to being stabbed by the victim, that there was at least a reasonable view of evidence that could have supported that conclusion. I just point the court to cases that have found that the combination of a bitter domestic argument and the victim using physical force against the defendant, those facts together provided a basis for a jury instruction. The court held that in the court has held that that is a sufficient basis. In Leinweber, there wasn't even a use of physical force, and the court found the basis for the jury instruction just based on the nature of the argument. And even though the defendant claimed it was an accident, even in all those sorts of circumstances in Leinweber were still sufficient to justify an instruction. So it's our position that the instruction would have been supported here based on what would have happened at trial.
Additional questions from the panel? Thank you. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.